I remember we signed the boy, Ismael Gonçalves. Nobody had heard him. I didn't even hear him until the week before, until Austin McPhee had brought him on our radar through Ian Cathro. We looked at video footage of him. We liked what we'd seen. We brought the boy over. We spoke. I think he was only over for maybe 3 or 4 days. And although we didn't know a great deal about him in terms of what he was going to bring, certainly Celtic wouldn't have known a great deal about him either. And that'd certainly be the case.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen, and for today's episode, we meet a man who is the catalyst for one of the most famous photos in Scottish football, from promotions as a player to advancement as an administrator, with League Cup success thrown into the mix. It's former St Mirren and Clyde gaffer, Danny Lennon. Danny, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, Ian. Thank you very much. Looking forward to chatting with you.
Now, let's start at the very beginning, Danny. Where were you born and brought up? Where are you from? Your roots?
I was brought up in West Lothian, what a wee town, mining village, Whitburn, and had a great childhood there, you know, playing lots of football in the playground when you were allowed to do so. Yeah, I wouldn't change that. I wouldn't change it at all. I had a great upbringing.
This was pre-Livingston days, so what were the kind of the clubs that kind of had your affections when you were growing up?
When I was younger, you obviously started off at the younger age groups, and there was, you know, the Cubs, etc., playing in the school football team, St Joseph's Primary, which was always a good challenge. So it was always producing good players. Brian Rice come from there. And a lot of good players that had fantastic potential, but probably just didn't have the mentality to go with it, Ian, which is very, very important. Went through the primary school at the age of around about 11, 10, 11. There was trials for a Whitburn Centre team starting out, and had four great years there. So we did under two fantastic coaches that, you know, were always there for you, helped you fall in love with the game. Bill McCabe and Johnny Fordyce, I'll never ever forget, you know, the time and the effort they put into a great group of guys, young players, and we had good success there. But 4 years is a long time, you know, probably looking back in hindsight now, and, you know, their wives, you know, complaining about how much time they're giving to the football. And they didn't go up to under 16s, neither they did. But Whitburn Centre at that time, we were in Scottish Cup finals, etc. They were a real good team out in the West Lothian area. And the teams from Edinburgh came when they knew that we weren't going up a few leagues, and, you know, headhunted a few of us. So a few of us all went to Hutchie Vale. I got offered to go to Tynecastle, which I originally agreed. Terry Wilson, who went on to play with Nottingham Forest, he was also from Whitburn, but he always played in the Edinburgh League, and he had been at Tynecastle for a good number of years. And I remember getting a call from Terry to see if I would be keen to join Tynecastle. At that point, I said I would, but then Hutchie Vale came in, and Hutchie Vale wanted about 3 or 4 of us from Whitburn, so they did, and I quickly jumped ship, went to Hutchie Vale, you know, liked what the club had to say. And it was actually another wee guy from Whitburn, who was a good friend at the time, wee Joe Meehan. He went to Tynecastle to play. And the amount of finals that we found ourselves in that year, very competitive, but Tynecastle done us practically in every one of the finals, so they did, Ian. So, but it was a great way to start that interaction. You know, you go into professional football clubs. Hibs came on the scene. I was down at Arsenal, you know, Dundee, and doing a few rounds at that particular time. But the connection with Hibernian Football Club and Hutchie Vale at that particular time, they were always at me. I went in and trained with them a couple of times a week. They were constantly at me to sign S forms. I wasn't keen because I was enjoying the experience the other other clubs keep my options open. At that time, S Form Strategy away, and I thoroughly enjoyed Hibs. So I did. My dad was a Hibs supporter as a young boy growing up. When they came calling, and when I knew that there was a concrete offer of signing S Form, but on the back of a 2-year apprenticeship also, I signed that the day before Christmas, 24. So we did, and you know, my dad and I went through, met with John Blackley, Gordon Neely, Tommy Craig, the full shebang, and Christmas certainly came early for us. And that summer I joined the ground staff along with some good players, and they were great times. They're some of my best times in football. Some of those ones, those early days, getting up to mischief and the kind of things that you do as young kids. I remember some of your chores at that particular time, Ian, where you had to make sure that the ground was clean. They were the days where you were allowed to go and do stuff, and you learned what it was all about in the real world. You were cleaning boots, you were cleaning dressing rooms, you were cleaning stands, etc. And I remember one time the 7 years were all out cleaning the terraces on a Monday morning. And we didn't like that because you're missing time in the training ground. We trained afternoon then. And I remember one day that one of us found a packet of Hamlet, you know, the 5 Hamlet cigars in a box. So we did. And sure enough, after training that afternoon, 5 years hopped behind the old shed at Easter Road at that time. And then 5 years were all, 7 years were all passing these 5 cigars all around. Honestly, the things that you do and experience. But I always had great memories of my time at Easter Road in the younger days.
Well, Alex Miller was the kind of incumbent manager for quite a long spell at the time you were there. He was very, say, Presbyterian in his approach, a very kind of, he came across as a quiet figure, maybe not so much behind the scenes, but did Alec influence you quite a lot in your career?
There's no doubt about that. First, I went in with John Blackley for I think it was 6 months, etc. And then, as you say, Alec came on board after very good success at St. Mirren Football Club. And he came through to the East. And what he certainly had, you know, great professionalism. I thought he was tactically way beyond his years in anything that we had experienced. He was way ahead in terms of the sports science that was now coming into Scotland at that particular time, and the way that players looked after themselves with a connection with the college, Murray House College it's called now. It was called Dunfermline College at that particular time. Brian Ewan he brought in as a sports science, very close to him, and you know, a good backroom staff with Peter Cormack at that time, Martin Ferguson, wee Jimmy McLaughlin, Stuart Colley, wee Andy Stevens, good physical, physiotherapy, medical department, etc. And he really had a good team behind the team. He had good players at Easter Road at that particular time, young players, so he did. But Alec was a big influence in my career. I'll never forget you giving me my debut against Morton. Derek McInnes and I actually made our debuts again in the same day, the same game. So we did. And we beat Morton 3-1 at Easter Road that day. And Andy Gorham actually scored from a goal kick.
I remember that.
Yeah, remember that. Well, that was mine and Derek's debut. And while Alec, you know, loved working in that atmosphere, he was demanding. You know, in football through and through, lived, breathed it. And good success in his own right in terms of winning the League Cup, etc., getting the club into Europe, so he did. But tactically aware of how to game plan and, you know, what I would call more now was proper tactical coaching at that particular time. Alec was big in that and team shape, etc., and he had very, very good success. I was there for, I think it was 7 years, and still under contract. And we'd get frustrated, you know, because you wanted regular game time, and there would be times that I would be in, times that I'd be out. And I think the best running games that I had around about that time, Ian, was maybe 8 games in the trot that I started. But you were up against good player, good competition, in that midfield area. And then you always knew that maybe when players were coming back from a lack of form or injury, you know, they would get that wee nod up. You had to be patient again. So it was like a stop start. But I could understand now, you know, why Alec kept me about, you know, as long as I was a good pro, good listener. I always remember one of the biggest compliments Alec gave me, and it was nothing to do when I was on the ball, but he always said that was one of the best that he'd seen tactically, you know, in keeping your position in the shape of the team and exactly where you had to be. So I took that, and I always remember another wee thing that he said. It's funny what you remember is how a coach makes you feel. And I still don't know that he didn't mean it as a compliment, but I took it as a compliment because I thought he was a great player. And I always remember one day, you know, I was a player that would give up all to get it again. And I remember him stopping me one day and he says, "You just pass the ball like Gordon Strachan, goes nowhere just to get the ball back." Love Gordon Strachan and he's the way that he played. So I did. But, you know, he would always demand. So it was good for me, for Alec. He was very helpful also in the exit and the way that they handled that and allowed me to, you know, at the age, I think, 20, 23 at that particular time, allowed me to go, you know, done a deal with Raith Rovers and Jimmy Nicol, and that was something that I had to go and pursue to really get my career kick-started again.
It's really interesting that you say that, because you think that sports science has a more kind of modern invention, like maybe the last 10 years. You wouldn't contemplate it being around in the 80s. Do you think your exposure to it so early on, do you think that made you...
He was massive on it. Brian Ewan, who also has been around for a long period of time, worked, you know, close in hand with the universities and the SFA. But Brian, I remember we used to have to go and we would get a close season program. You'd get tested before you went away. You had to have, you know, so many stats when you came back, and then you would go to the university and you would go on a running machine and you would have to come off and they would be taking the lactic acid to the blood and the pricks of the needles, etc., but way back to the lab. And it was certainly a way ahead. And I think in terms of how the game and that had went, it really got you thinking about not just how you were as a footballer, you know, when you were in and around the club and coming to training, but also the behaviour should be 24/7.
Well, when you said you were moving to Raith Rovers, Jimmy Nicols, the manager there at the time, a lot of times when you a player moves to a club, you take into...
Just cut in there, while we're talking before jumping onto the Easter Road, the Raith Rovers stories, I remember a couple of years in pre-season tours that Alec took us away to a German training camp for 2 years running in Germany, in Werl, and it was run with the Royal Scots Army. So it was, and the first year went great, so it was, and you're up and down these hills, you were away, we were sleeping in the army barracks, etc. In the sergeant's mess, well looked after, but it was real hard, and you know, that was one thing that you could never ever say. We were a very, very fit organisation under Alec. So I remember the second year coming and we went back to Viero and we knew exactly what was happening. There was a big hill and it was nicknamed Adjective Hill. You know, everybody hated that. And you knew that exactly where you were going with it. And I remember this one time in Germany, and the camp went on to red alert. Red alert meant that they were now walking about with live ammunitions and securing, locking the place down, etc. And what happened was about 50 kilometres or something from Werl, the army camp we were in, there was talk in the IRA of people out with the... And there was a bombing at another camp. So we were a wee bit uneasy with this. We were going to go home, etc. And we were out there for something like 12 days or something like that. So everybody was at edge, and this went on for a good 3 to 4 days. But as you get in there and you say, well, we're quite secure, we carried on and whatever. But I had a close I had a cousin that was actually in the Royal Scots at the time, Pat McHale. He's up in Inverness now and out of the army and medically retired. Served his country absolutely fantastically well. And I remember planning this. So I went and got two army suits off him, balaclavas, the boots, the gloves, they name it, and the big Rambo knives. So we did. And we brought them back into our room. And this went on, and myself and wee Mickey Weir, we were about the same height. And he says, right, Mick, you and I are doing this. And we planned a couple of days before that we went into some of the younger boys' rooms and stole their keys so that they couldn't lock the door at night. We're making noise. Did you hear that last night? And building the story up. Yeah, we heard this, and making sure that the young boys were in earshot of us. So we'd planned this, and Mick and I put all this gear on, put the balaclavas on, and honestly, looking in the mirror, it was for real. Even the boys, Billy Finlay, Wally Muller, Chris Reed, boys that were in our room, you know, you could see the fear. So Mick and I, we've went over and we've rattled the young boys' door, knowing that it wasn't locked, and their lights off. But as you went in, we quickly flickered the light on and off so that they could just get a glimpse of us in this balaclavas, big Rambo knife and army gear. And we says, right, this is the IRA. Well, you won't have heard this. So we've got Andy Donald, who was one of the young kids who was on the closest bed. So he's pretending that he's sleeping. We get to hear this at the end. So he's seen us flick with the light, and he's just closed his eyes and kid, you don't know, he's sleeping all the way through. We've then got Stevie Raines, Wee Lee Bailey in the next again bed. Big Ian Siegel, he slept all the way through it, and we get wee Stevie Raines on the faraway bed. So we go over, and Mickey and I are pulling wee Stevie Raines out the bed. So we're saying, you're coming with us. No, please. And the tears and the floods and everything starts to come. So it is. Wee Lee Bailey's are crying, no, I've got a family and all that. Well, all of a sudden, Mickey had to take his mask off because they were going into hysterics. And I'm sure that they three boys are still getting counselling to this day. So they are. So we come out of that room in the commotions. We actually had done big Stephen Tweed, who was in his own room as well. And the commotion going down. But all the staff at that time were away over in the sergeant's mess playing snooker and having a few beverages. And we were away down this big long corridor. And you could hear the door. We seen the doors open up at the far end. And I says, Mick, that's the gaffer and that coming in. So I says, I'm going for it. So I've still got the Rambo knife, I've got the gear. And it's one of the ones that every time you walk 5 or 10 yards, one light comes on. So I'm getting closer and closer to them. And you can see the staff starting to venture and hide in between wee door openings. You've got Pierre Cornack going in, you've got Martin Ferguson, you've got wee Andy Stevenson. So I'm going for Alec right away, and I'm there, and I've got this knife out, and I just grab him by the collar like that. And I just couldn't hold my laugh in any longer, and I burst out laughing, taking the mask off. And he says, you lucky wee bastard. He says, I was just about to buck in my enjoy you there. Well, it was absolutely incredible, and it's one of the best ones that ever went down. So it was, maybe that's why I didn't get so many games.
Just remind us what country you represented at under 21 level.
Exactly. There you go. Maybe that's how. Yeah. Maybe that's how I get caps in.
Well, I mean, from representing Northern Ireland to being under one of their greatest players as manager was Jimmy Nicol. Sometimes when you have somebody that's high profile, because Jimmy played that 82 Cup team that was brilliant. Played for Man United. Sometimes players kind of get a bit bedazzled by the manager, and sometimes the manager's...
I've always been, Ian, any manager that I've had the pleasure of playing under, I've always tried to take something good to what I've liked, you know, in a style. Some things that I wouldn't do that. Some things I wouldn't touch. And I've always done that. As I said there, Alec was so meticulous in every area. You know, technically, tactically, and, you know, physically, even mental aspects of the game. And Jimmy Nicol, what a wonderful career, what a wonderful personality and character that he has. And we always knew who Jimmy was. Jimmy, I always remember playing with Hibernian in the reserves and going to Ibrox. Jimmy was in charge of Rangers reserves and that at the time, and he would still be playing, you know, and that was great for me, you know, to be going and playing against the likes of the players of that ilk. I always remember John McMaster going down to Morton and play. This one always sticks in my head. As a younger player going down, and John was a player, assistant player coach or something at Morton at the time, as his career was coming to an end. I remember playing a reserve game there, and oh, what a football lesson this man gave. But he learnt so much. So he did. And Jimmy was a bit like that. Jimmy was a bit like that. But you've obviously left an impression any time that you played against that quality. And, you know, he tells me, when I was in working with him, he tried to get me a couple of times, as I said there, you know, Alec, you know, didn't bring the deal to my attention, which they were entitled to do in those days. I was making no noise that I wanted to be elsewhere, and maybe showed a bit of frustration and lack of game time, etc. But when that opportunity presented itself, you know, it was right for all parties, and particularly for me at the end of the day. And I had a great time under Jimmy Nicol and Martin Harvey, again, great team, backroom team staff, Jerry Docherty, who even as a manager, when I went to St Mirren, took him with me, became very good friends, John Valente. It was just a great, even the chairman, Alex Penman, Wally Gray, it was just a club that was enjoying a great journey at that particular time. And so it was, you know, punching well above its weight, going in there and coming into a first team dressing and the character, these were proper characters. So they were Ronnie Coyle, Gordon Dalziel, big Ali Graham. Ali Graham, I always remember a player, and he was a good player. I thought Ali, for the size that he wasn't just a target man. He had a beautiful first touch. He linked the play, allowed you to go in. And he scored some very, very important goals. On his day, he was a real hand for it, was big Ali. But one of the big things, his shirts, when he came to training, they were always immaculate. They were like railway lines, honestly. The things that you remember of players, eh? I says, Ali, who does? He was so meticulous in the way that he hung his cellar. Always took good pride in his appearance. But some of these guys, they were great. I remember one time, the stories we used to get when you'd be on the Forth Road Bridge and there'd be a conveyor belt here, somebody's coming back through to the west for Fife, etc. And you'd maybe get stopped at the Forth Road Bridge because you paid the toll at that particular time. And see if you were stopped in traffic a long while and maybe in the sunshine, your windows and that down, and they would come and they would sneak you when they see them coming in, and they would pinch your car keys and turn the ignition off. And you're just absolutely standing here away. I remember one time also coming across the Forth Road Bridge. We're sitting there and you would be getting all the dross, you know, you're 70 to make up the 70 pence. You always try to give the guys the exact change in the morning. But I remember this one time we come through and we've got the coin. So what was it again? It was something like a 50 pence piece and 2 10 pence pieces. And I always remember we got the 2 10 pieces, 10 pieces, and jammed them in between put the 50 pence piece in between the 2 tens. And we got the lighter, you know, for the car, and we held up the 50 pence piece. So we were handed it all over. It roasted the shenanigans we used to get up to. Oh, it was incredible.
That Rafe team were incredibly talented. I mean, you talked about the experienced players. You had some really good youngsters as well that were coming through, like Stevie Crawford, Colin Cameron. And Rafe got to the 94 League Cup final, but you were injured for that final. Yeah. Was that maybe one of the most bittersweet moments of your career?
Yeah, no doubt about that. As I said, you highlighted some great players there, and I think one of the biggest strengths of Raith Rovers was the togetherness. Jimmy was massive on that. Always goal fountains, everybody loved that. And I thought that was Raith Rovers' biggest strength. Although there was good individual players there, that connection of players and the social side of it was incredible. Jimmy was so infectious with his love for the game and his enthusiasm. And the way he went about that, fantastic storyteller. Going into that, I then, in my first season, I went in the last transfer window But that summer, Jimmy made me club captain. So he did. And that did turn a few of the boys' noses up. A younger player coming in. And there's players there that have said that club, as I say, is experienced. And that was a wee challenge because you've then got to go and earn that respect for these guys. And it was a wee bit standoffish. I found it. How you cope with that, etc. But I think any time that you then go and do that, and perhaps you go out there and then show it in your performances, players quickly come round, and good players, good pros, they always respect good players that are going to come in and try and aid and enhance, you know, their club. And we did. I became captain then. We went on a fantastic run. In the League Cup that season, so we did, and we Colin Cameron was inspirational. I remember him scoring a hat trick, Big Ali Graham scoring hat tricks in those cup competitions, and we went to the final. And a week before the final, we were up in the training ground, up at Beveridge Park, just a local park, and the younger boys were in training with us, and just a young kid, you know, had caught me late. You know, with his studs. And I just thought it was a crack in the foot to begin with, but it was a sore one. I says, I'll be fine. Got up, and I ran for about another minute or two, and then just as I went, I must have just been stressing it and stressing it, and you just heard the crack. So that was me out for that. And as much as I was gutted, Jimmy was absolutely wonderful with me. He still made me a big party. Everything that was going on, we went away, every part of the preparations involved me in everything, so that was great to be in and around the boys. But as quickly as you get over that disappointment, you're there supporting, and it was an absolutely fantastic occasion. Always say the bittersweet side of that was, although missing out in the cup final itself, didn't miss out in the celebrations or anything like that, but it's never quite the same when you're not playing in it, Ian. Regardless, but I always felt for me the success of that League Cup win was, you know, the club getting into Europe, and, you know, I had a fantastic experience in that with the club.
Well, I think all the fans of Raith Rovers had a fantastic experience with you in Europe as well, yeah. Danny, you hit one of the most spectacular free kicks in Scottish football history, getting such good topspin on it, the ball moved, totally bamboozled the goalkeeper, when you're over in Munich. And to be honest, I mean, it was a nobody in goals. Nobody had heard of him. Who was it again that was the keeper?
Oh, the can. Yeah. I mean, what a great experience that was, but start to finish. But not even just the German experience, you know, going through the qualifier, the preliminary rounds before it. I think we played a team from the Faroe Islands, and I managed to score in the return leg over there. Then we played a team called Akranes from Iceland, who were a very, very good outfit, had a few good players. You remember the Goodison twins?
Yep.
Went on to play with, I think, would it be Leicester or something like that? One of them went on to play with. One had hair, one had a complete bald or shaved or whatever, but what good talent, say we are. And we beat them. What a great atmosphere at Stark Park that night. And we beat them 3-1, and I managed to score a brace that night. And I think it was Barry Wilson that scored the third one. And we took a 3-1 lead over to Akranes in the return leg. And I remember the game plan Jimmy had set up with some banks. You know, it was like a back six and a four. We just defended, talking about, it's the first time I've ever been involved with parking the bus at that stage. But it worked for us, and I think we lost the game 1-0. The game was in a bit. We defended very, very admirably, and got ourselves into the draw with the big guns. And I always remember coming back from training at that particular time, and from Ralston, and the draw had came through, and the place was absolutely, you know, electric when we knew that we were playing Bayern Munich. It was a great experience, and I think any player at that time, regardless of what level you're playing at, you want to challenge and play against the best players and see how you fare up against them. the levels that they reach, not just every now and again, but consistent. And that's why they play at the top level. So that was a great journey. And, you know, being up against the likes of Can, Papin, Klinsmann, Babel, you know, I was directly against the Swiss international, their captain. I think Papin missed a penalty in the return leg. So he did, but just like Nerlinger, you know, players of great ilk, and that was an incredible experience. So it was.
What was it that sparked your move away from Raith Rovers? Because you were there until 99, and then you joined Thistle.
Once again, Ian, after good success, and again going to Raith Rovers, they were only a game or two away from going back into the first division from the Premier at that time. But I knew that was probably going to be the outcome when I went there. But it was first team football that I wanted to get closer to regular. And then in that following season, we get the League Cup run. We win the league. We come back up. So we had very good success. And then, as you would imagine, with the success that the club had and what Jimmy had, clubs came calling for him. He went to Millwall, which was a big disappointment because I loved playing for Jimmy. He was infectious, as I said. And he went down south. And then the club was going through that transition period. There was players leaving. Jimmy had came and took, you know, the likes of Crawford. I think, who was the other one? Jason Deere and Sinkey. He took the three in a package. And obviously, that was financially good for Raith as well. Colin Cameron, I think, then went to Hearts. So there was the breakup of a team. And listen, these guys deserve to move on. They deserve the club well. And they deserve to play in the highest, in the bigger leagues. So that's where their talent deserved to be. But for the rest of us, and I always remember that breakup. And I remember Willie Gray, the director, they were desperate for somebody to sign that was already at the club. So I did. You know, I'm quite loyal that way, in terms of when somebody looks after you, you give that a little bit back. And I ended up signing a new contract there. It didn't quite work out with the managements that came in prior to that. I think we quickly went through three managers in a year. Jimmy Thompson, Tommy McLean came in for 5 days or something, then jumped ship to go to, I think he only took one game against Aberdeen. He then jumped ship to go to his brother up at Dundee United. And then Ian Monroe came in. So I think we had three managers within the 1 year. And then Ian had left. I think we'd survived again there. You'd maybe hate to check the stats on that one. I can't really recall that one. And at that time, Jimmy didn't have the best of experiences down in Millwall. And, you know, was relieved. He was back in the market. And naturally, for the success, the club went back and got him. And I had a couple of meetings with him prior to that. He convinced me to sign again. He wanted to build a team round about it. And things went reasonably well for the first season and that. But then I picked up a few injuries, so I did. And it was getting difficulty. Then the club ran into a bit of financial difficulty. They found it a struggle. And we parted ways that fall in summer. But I had, I think it was four or five fantastic years up there, so I did, and you know, moved on once again, and that's football, and I think it's important the way that you enter a club, but I think it's also very important the way that you exit a club, and you know, the connections that we've spoke about, you know, I'm always well received any time that I go back up. I always enjoy the company. And it's one thing that I've always said that Raith Rovers do better than any other club. I believe they hang on to their successes very well, you know, and they promote them well. I think they're wonderful at that, because when are you ever really going to hear Raith Rovers and Bayern Munich mentioned in the same sentence? You know, these are wee fairy tales.
Well, when I had Gary Miller on, he was Ross County when they won the Cup, and Derek Adams was the manager, and I asked, is it true that Derek Adams doesn't swear? And he confirmed that Derek Adams doesn't swear. So you went to Partick Thistle with John Lambie. Can you confirm to us that John Lambie doesn't swear at all?
Oh, John had the best adjectives going, so he did. What a character, what a man. And he was great for me. What had basically happened with that deal? From leaving Raith Rovers, I then went down on a short-term contract to Ayr United. Gordon Deal, old teammate, was manager down there. Gordon asked me to go down. He was having a few injury problems, suspensions. And he gave me a short-term deal, 3 months, etc. I'll be honest, I thought that I deserved more than what I showed there. But nonetheless, and then a deal came in from North County. Yeah, it meant moving up north, etc. And I enjoyed that experience as well, although I just had a one-year-old boy, my first son, Keelan, and my wife are still down the road. And for about, I think, 6-7 weeks, and it just wasn't right. I was shown in flashes what I could do, but whether that was because I was far from the loved ones, my young family, etc. I didn't quite work out the way that I wanted in terms of the football. I thought that they deserved more from me. And they did, played under Neil Cooper. And Neil was a very, very highly strung individual, shall we say. Neil didn't miss players, when they weren't doing it for him. And you could understand, as a younger manager for Neil at that time, the stresses and the pressures that go along with that. And I always felt him, he's very, very, very high maintenance. He's very, very emotionally detached from himself. He's got to try and control that. But I remember meeting him on a plane one time going to Magaluf. And honestly, what a different guy away from football. And we had a fantastic week together, so we did. God rest him. And he was a good, good man, was Neil Cooper. But going on that with the six to eight weeks that I had up at Ross County, there was a bit of noise now coming from Partick Thistle. And what basically happened, Derek Ferguson came up for Thistle. I went for Ross County and we just changed over. Thistle were struggling a wee bit struggling big time in the second division, near the bottom of it or round about that end of the table under John Lambie. And I went down there and I really enjoyed the environment. I loved the big club and the history behind that club. The fans, they were well turned out, even although the position that they were in. And I started to enjoy my football. I was back in amongst, my family. And it just hit off. And slowly, gradually, the team started to pick up. John was bringing in other players, I remember. Like say Peter Lindu, good young players coming in. Scott McLean, he then brought in the likes of Sandy Stewart, Alan Moore, good experienced players. That's what John Lambie was very good at, surrounding himself with good experienced pros that could manage that dressing and manage the pitch for him. But he was the one that could identify those characters. He was a great judge of character, was John. One of the biggest things that I took for John was his integrity. John could shoot you down in a sentence, but pick you very quickly back up in the next sentence. So he was brilliant in that. And have you ever had a run in with John, or you maybe had some words crossed over? And whenever you met John again out with that conversation, it was as if it never happened. It was incredible, I thought. And he'd been round the block. But as I said, there good success there. He started to build a team. And I think we actually went into the quarterfinals of the Scottish Cup that year. We narrowly got put out with United down there. John was a character. He used to come out with some antidote, so he did, and he would always make us laugh. You'd hear him on the radio. He would come out with things, and how you say, oh, shot ourselves in the foot there. He would come out and shot ourselves in the arms. But he was brilliant. He was oblivious to that, and he had great success going into a following season. We got a promotion. They were great times. So they were absolutely wonderful. And he deserved that. And it wasn't the first time he was a magician. I don't know. You'd have to check in. I don't know if he holds the most stats for promotions. Teams coming up. He'll be very, very close to it. So he will. Once again, getting back-to-back two promotions, two titles in a row. Won the first, second division. Won the first division. Then that was back up into the Premiership. But going away back when he brought Sandy Stewart and Mark McNally, wee Alan Moore, it was great because Alan and Sandy were, I felt that they still had a lot to offer, particularly in the second division at that time with their experience, but they were great for the dressing room, they were great for the younger lads. But what they were fantastic pros, so they were. I remember Sandy went out of the team at one stage, but you know, as a good pro he was, he never ever spat the dummy out. John would ask him to do a little bit of coaching, and Sandy was getting more and more involved in that side of the game, but always kept his cell ready, and then he would come back in, and that would be him. Alan, a wee bit more opinionated, and at that particular time, when he signed Alan, Alan was a winger, as you know, but the players that John had recruited, we quickly found a formation of three at the back, and five in the midfield, and wing back for wee Alan at that particular time was a hard shift, so it was, and younger legs, fresher legs came in. So Alan's time became a little bit, game time became a little bit less, but I always remember when we won the second division, Ian, that the way John, you could have the run, but there was never any grudges, never anything held against you. And him and Alan had a few disagreements, as I say, both of them are very, very opinionated guys. And none of the two of them would back down. But there was always a mutual respect there. But I remember presentation day, the last game of the season, and all the families and that are there. And, you know, as great managers do, John puts Murray in the starting 11, knowing that it's going to be his last game, etc. His family not on the stand. So the way that he managed and how he made people feel, and always remember, regardless of whatever happened with Alan and John behind that, you know, with a lack of game time, etc. All I hear Alan talking about is how John made him feel, you know, in that day in front of his family. I'll never forget that. But going back into stories with John, I always remember, you know, there was one time again, Sandy and Alan, and we went to Blackpool, as you do with John, you know, at the beginning of January, for the big do, the Blackpool do convention, where he would meet all these pigeon cronies, etc. And it was a great wee break. As I say, Thistle were absolutely wonderful. Best club I've been at in terms of Raith Rovers was a great social and team spirit with the players. But Partick Thistle took it to another level because they brought the families in that and involved. Everybody was a part of it here. So we would go away and we had this connection, team bonding. Mark McNally, you know, big Scott McLean, we Jordy Shaw, great cadres. At young players coming through, Stephen Docherty, Alan Archibald, we Derek Lyle, we Dunsey, guys like that, Kenny Arthur, goalkeeper. But we'd go to Blackpool, and John would always let you go out and have a few beers, you know, and whatever. So there'd be the Friday. And then I remember this, we're down for maybe 3 days or something. And then the Saturday, we were allowed, we trained, etc. And then we were allowed to go out. It might have actually been the Sunday, coming back in the Monday. But we were allowed to for a few beers. And I can definitely say there was no curfew given here, neither was. But we went away to this pub, Yates's, etc. There's 7 years out there. So there is. And the crack's flowing, you can imagine. We're playing cheeky-cheeky. This wee trialist guy was out there. So I can't mind, quite not mind his name. But it's the best game of cheeky-cheeky, you know, for the suit of the exhaust. And you're just a touch somebody's face, but he's actually getting the black marks. And honestly, he was like Al Johnson at the end of it, but everybody's coming. And I always remember in the 80s, there was a few transvestites in that night. So there was, so these transvestites are coming over, and we're all having a great time. We eventually get back to the hotel, and as we are, you're greedy, and we're trying to get served behind the bar. And the wee porter guy there is serving us. Obviously, we're not the quietest, and there's a bit of commotion, etc. And who comes down the stair but John? So we've obviously disturbed him. He's got the wee porter booth. Oh, what did I tell you about serving these guys? What did I tell you? So what time used to be? There was no curfew, Gaffer, but quickly, we all go to bed. So we're all sentenced to bed. And the next again morning, we all come down. And at that time, there was two kit men. God rest the two of them, Chico and Ricky. They were absolutely fantastic. They ran the club. So they did. They were great with the young players. Never ever let players feel sorry for themselves. They were always on the red. They were just great crack. But what quickly happened there? So John, and sometimes I even think now, did he premeditate that, you know, to get the outcome of what he'd done? So the next again day, he gets wee Davy and he gets wee Ricky and wee Chico, and he gets these guys to go into rooms. And they're going in and out of rooms, and we think they're going and picking up the kit, etc. But what they're doing, they're planting evidence, right? So they're like a wee matchbox full of sugar and that, and they're planting evidence in some of your etc. So we come down for lunch, and after lunch, we trained. Then after lunch, he says, "Right, I want everybody back down here after dinner. We've got a kangaroo court for the seven that were out last night." So we're like that. So we're just getting about, and then this, that, you know, we know what's coming. So they set this up, and in the hotel that we were in, it couldn't have worked any better. They had a set of cast iron gates that you could see through that separated it. So it was like a jail. So that was the jail. So what we done, the seven of us, we had these training T-shirts, and they were just white, plain T-shirts, out of the blue. And what we'd started to do, we wrote the magnificent, Free the Blackpool 7. That's what we put on them. So as we were coming in, Free the Blackpool 7 at the front. And then as you come in, says, it wasn't me. And then the next one would say, aye, it was. And the next one would say, no, it wasn't. And the next one would say, aye, I saw you. So it went on like that. So we're coming in there and we come into the court, and John's sitting there as judge, Jerry with the evidence. And he's got the court marshals, Ricky and Chico, and wee Davey as the bailiff, bringing us all in. So John's got his mic there, which he used to analyse his pigeon droppings. So he did. So they're then reading out the charges to us in this kangaroo court. So they're bringing this evidence. And as I said, there was a wee white box there in the way. They says, have you ever seen this substance before? It was sugar. Yeah, and whoever was getting the sentence, I think it was maybe wee Jordy, he says, yes, I have. And he says, have you ever tasted that substance before? He says, well, I'm not quite sure what it is. He says, well, dip your finger in. He says, have you tasted that substance before? He says, I have. He says, right, that's enough. So they planted the drugs on him. So they did. So he was getting done for that, and they're bringing that to the court. So then the court, John's got us in this jail, and wee Paul McGrillin, God rest him, they're all giving evidence against the Blackpool 7. There was a curfew, etc. They're putting the knife right into us, really, really doing us in big time. So we're in there, and then you get to the crux of the sentencing. So he's now passing out the sentences, which are now going into £100 fine in that. So we're asking, what is the £100 for? There was no curfew. Yeah, we'll get evidence there was. You were late, disrupting the whole hotel, etc. Plus, definition of, you know, ruining club attire with the T-shirts with the writing on them. We're saying, Gafford, come on, they're only £2 a T-shirt if you're lucky, etc. So he's now passing out a sentence, and he's passing the sentence out for £50 a T-shirt. So he is. He's then giving us tight. So as I said, we Alan Moore. Alan's no the quietest of guys. So Alan's no having it. He said, I'm accepting, you're fine, and it's getting a wee bit. No, I'm not accepting it. I'm pulling him, and I'm saying, no, just let it slip, you man. Just let him have his time, you know. We don't have to win everyone. Just make sure that you're fine. No, I'm not putting up with that. No, he can't just take money out of his office for the sake of that. And unknown to run about the Christmas period, Alan, John used to have us all in on a Sunday. So he did. And Jerry Collins, God rest him, just passed away last week there. Great character and a great footballing man. And Jerry would always come in with a bugle that meant you were always running. So John always had us in on a Sunday after a game. So he did. And this time, Murray was had a function on his wife, and it was a fancy dress at the Christmas period. And he was one of the ugly sisters, and he still came in with the suspenders and his ugly to train that day. And he says, I'm going to training this today. So John was in his office. So John never seen it. So Moody's running about the training ground or whatever, playing in this game. And his suspenders and that are falling down. So they are. But it was a right great crack. So back to the Blackpool thing. Is that right? You're not accepting this fine? No, I'm not. I'm not accepting that. It's shite the way you're treating us, all this, blah, blah, blah. And John, just quick as a flash, you know, just kicked. He says, right, okay, if you're not accepting this fine, let's go the Sunday, the week after Christmas. How do you plead, you know, coming in there, fans? And Wee Murray just put his hands up. He says, I'll take your £80, your £100 fine. But the way John just manipulated and always got his own way, he was absolutely fantastic. I remember one time being in his office going in for something. What time are we going out to train, Gaffer? And you always went in and it was something like, you know, tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be, you would come out, dead smoke about the cigars, etc. And they're all in there and John would be puffing away. And I remember going in and there's this foreign agent in there and he's with this big lad here. And he was a big, big unit. He looked very, very athletic, the guy. So he did. So we're in there and John introduced me and he says, right. So as the conversation's going, John says to the agent guy, he says, well, what's the boy like? And the boy says, he is absolutely athletic, so he is. So John, who had a good hairy head on him for his age, etc. John used to always blow dry his hair and he had a hairdryer plugged in down the bottom. And he goes down and he picks up the hairdryer and he says to the boy, he says, listen, son. He says, this is bucking electric, he says, but can he play? He was absolutely brilliant and all that, so he was. One of the other ones, Des McEwen tells a good story. So he does when he's on the dinner circuits. We were away coming back a trip from Forfar. So as we were, and as you do, you get the card school and all that going in the back of the bus after a good win. And the stories are going, some of the boys are having a few beers, maybe no driving at the other end. And John allowed that, if you had a good day. So he's coming up the back of the bus, seeing who's winning the cards and a wee bit of crack and whatever. And as he's probably had a couple of whiskies himself. So he's coming up the back and the boys were playing this game, talking about that if you're stranded on a desert island, who would you take with you? So the likes of myself and I've says Kylie Minogue and Alan Archibald, he says Danny Minogue and, you know, saying, where about if we meet up for Christmas dinner and all that? All that type of stuff, and others are saying all type of different people. So he comes up, and Des says to the gaffer, we're playing this game. Danny would be stranded on a desert island with Kylie Minogue. Archie would be, you know, wanted to be stranded with Danny Minogue. Who would you be stranded with, Gaffer, on a desert island? And you can see him thinking, you know, and he's thinking hard, and he comes back at Des, and he says, I'd take my brother. And we're all saying, what? All the options you've got and you're going to take your brother down? He says, aye. He says, why would you take your brother down? He says, he's got a boat. Oh, he was brilliant with AV stories. Brilliant. Very, very shrewd man. I remember we were in the Premiership and I remember myself, Jamie Dolan, again, God rest him, and we, Derek Fleming. John was obviously there. West Lothian way. We would meet and the boys would meet at my house and John would pick us up just to save in club fuel, etc. Every penny counted. But on a Friday, the four of us, we would put our, at that particular time when it was allowed, you would put bets on. So you would recoup it. So you'd all pick a team each and John would make it that you had to pick a team that was no less than, you know, 2-1, etc. So you had to put, you couldn't just put, pick out big certainties, etc. So there was one of the favourite restaurants away back from Marriott Rovers days, that Peter Heatherston, who again a great player, and I only had a short period with Peter, but a great guy. Love bumping into Peter. But Peter introduced me to the restaurant at Colt Brig called Guidi's. It's Italian, not there at the minute. Went by, but there may be one back up. Hope they do. Me and my family went there for many, many years. So I says, listen, there's a great restaurant on the way home. Let's go there. So we started to go there and we would just chip in a bit of pasta, whatever. But then we started, as I said there, you had to pick a team who would, the four teams would be on. So four teams basically are tenner ahead and the four teams had to come up here, you know, for the bet to come through, obviously. Now, the deal was that if your team let the coupon down, you then had to buy the greedies. You know, you had to buy the greedies the next week. So if the three let it down, you split it three ways. If there's two that let it down, you split it two ways. If it was one, it was a big hit for the one that let them down. John Lambie never went into his pocket once. Not once. Shrewd man, shrewd man.
Well, one thing that begs the question, like when you're talking about the kind of kangaroo core and the fact that managers and players are always at odds with one another in terms of do they get to go out, misbehave and that kind of stuff. Did you ever had to preside over a situation when you were manager,
yeah,
when you had a player and you just thought, what on earth was he thinking?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Without giving names away, there's situations and you get little gut feelings. And I remember one situation at St Mirren. There was a player and we get a call in the Monday morning. It was after the weekend. I'm calling the Monday morning to say this player wouldn't be in for training. Right, okay, what's happened? The reason was there was a car accident or a so-called car accident. Right, is he okay? Has he been checked out? Hospital? Bump, bump, bump. Wee bit of whiplash or whatever it may be. So we have received this phone call from the parent. So you take that for word that, you know, just one of the wee things is your experience and it just tells you it's no sitting right on Monday morning. It was eating away at me. So it was. And I really like this boy. Good player. And went on to have a great career, to be fair to him. But what basically happened, I says, this isn't sitting well with me. And I had a good friend of mine who was in the police. So I phoned him up after training. I says, do me a wee favour and let me know if there was a car accident at such and such a place today. So sure enough, he goes and investigates, comes back to me, gives me the information. There was no. So this, he was doing a wee bit of work at the club as well, this guy. So he actually phones the player himself and he says, look, it's better coming for yourself rather than it coming for me. So you're caught within that. But there's some situations there where you say, why did players, you know, we are all human. We all make mistakes. But managers are human as well. And we understand that human side of the game. So there is. I also remember a time when I took my St. Mirren team away to, we used to go to, San Roque, away down by Marbella, away down that way. And it was a lovely pre-season. The boys loved it, you know, great facilities and great work. But as the boys worked, you would give them that night out. And I recall after a game, we'd agreed on a time, a curfew that the players would be in. But this wasn't good enough for them, Ian, that curfew. So they managed to stretch another hour or something out of you. But when you say, right, I'll give you another hour or whatever, that's always not good enough for them. Neither it was. So they said then now that they weren't going. I said, right, that's it. Put in the head and we just came back. And you try and protect them in a sense that you know that they want to go out there and have a good time. And I get that. But when there's a group of 22 players all together, there's many, many mixed characters. Not every one of them handles alcohol in the same way, etc. And you don't need nonsense come to your door. You know, enough nonsense does come to your door. You don't have to go and find it. And a lot of them have went into that side of the game now and hopefully they'll understand these things. So there's a timing and a place for it. But they didn't go. But what I did find out, Ian, a few years later when I'd left the club, etc., they all went out anyway, so they did when they went back to the hill, back to the thing. But that's the way it is, you know. They go and you disappoint. Oh, listen, I think if you go and you do these type of things and they feel that that's right at a particular time, just don't get caught. You know, there's enough nonsense, as I say, throughout a season. We'll find a manager's door without having to go and look for everything. I used to always say that to the staff, and I always had good members of staff that had that good connection with the players that need to know everything, but I need to know the important things that are going to have the reflection on the team. So always working within that. But you know, players are always looking for that little bit of edge, that little bit, you know, more than what you give. They're human beings at the end of the day.
If you want any kind of comfort, Danny, that St Mirren's got precedent, but this is within the journalistic fraternity, because the football reporter for the Paisley Daily Express once decided after a few beers to phone in and say, I can't make it in, my train's had an accident. So the first thing they did was, oh, there's been a train crash, that's a news story. And yeah, he was
definitely so, you know. If you're going to give out an excuse like that, and there's been things like that, you know, in terms of where you're going, I understand families want to protect their kids, etc. But I think in terms to getting the process, managers, coaches, chairman, we're all human beings, and there is a human side to us. You know, we were all young ourselves, you know, and ambitious, and we don't understand that these kind of situations happen. But you know, it's like you try and be a father figure to these kids at the same time. You know, you're not the father, but when they're in the nursing environment, you've got so much, not so much control over them, but so much time and your influence on them. You want them to do the same sort of things that you would maybe bring your own kids up to. And I think that's the key thing, that when you're working with good football players, you also want to be working with good human beings, you know, and that mutual respect and that trust.
I think that's a good point. And certainly when you were at St Mirren, one of the best kind of characters that you had, and he's still involved in the game, somebody you would have trusted in the training ground, certainly not to pick up a corner flag and throw it at Scotland's best player for the last 30 years. Were you actually in charge when Stephen Thompson...
No, I just left at that particular time. Great to see Stevie. You know, he was always cut out for, you know, media work, you know, big handsome chap, well-groomed all the time. And everybody, when we'd signed Stevie, thought that he was just coming back to fizzle his career out at his boyhood heroes, and you know, that was that. But once again, we managed to build a squad up of good players coming in at a particular time. Jim Goodwin, Gary Teal, you know, good pros, people that had been there, done it. Managed to secure wee Paul McGowan on a permanent deal, tying up deals with Alan Pardew at Newcastle for Dummett and Paul Dummett and Connor Newton, you know, these type of players. Boys that had served the club very well, Lee Mayer, Van Zanten, a couple of Dutch players came in, Yuri Tesla, Tavner, you know, all these guys throughout. But at that particular time when Stevie came in, he was absolutely fantastic in terms of what he gave the football club. I always give him the biggest compliment. He's the best striker that I've worked with personally, you know, in terms of balls coming into wide areas and just drifting away from defenders and then getting across them right at the last minute as they're looking at the ball where they don't see his timing to get to the front post at the exact same time as what the ball was arriving at the front post was impeccable, the amount of goals that he had is there. Stevie could be a wee bit of a challenge himself, you know, on a daily basis. You know, he would blurt out and he would say, what are we doing this for? And bump, bump, bump. I always had an arrangement with Stevie, you know, anytime we were in one-on-one meetings when I signed, he says, look, if it's too much for you or anything that we're doing, you've got the, you manage your own body, etc. You know, you go and do and what you need right for you to make sure that you're, and he would come out with things during training, you know, you'd maybe do a bit of shaping and he maybe not be involved and you're maybe asking him to fill here or do whatever. And I get that. And he'd just blurt, what are we doing this shite for? All that type of nonsense. Yeah. Now, it's all very well, I'm thinking. And I used to just answer, I say, look, Steve, I've had this with you before. But you're not getting nothing out of it. Just you go away in. Now, you would never go away in because you've now pulled him in front of the whole squad there. And after training, you know, and he would never cause you any problem. He would just got on me and whatever, but then you would have a wee word with him in the office or something after training. I say, look, Stevie, I totally get it. You're not getting that, and I totally understand that everything's not going to be in the way that you like it, etc. But don't blurt out silly comments like that in front of the younger kids. Teach them how good pros you know, should behave, etc. And he wouldn't, and he would just come around and he says, I know, he says, I think I get a wee bit of Tourette's at times, you know, he doesn't think before he says, but he was absolutely a great character, a great image for the club, always well-spoken, so he was, and a great influence in these players, for the likes of John McGinn, these younger players coming through, Anne Moy, wee Paul McGinn, he was a great boy, but, That was a bizarre situation and one that I'm sure that would be one of his biggest regrets. But you know, have you ever been hit with the force of John McGinn's arse, and you'll know that it can be pretty sore.
Yeah, no response to that. One of the things that's really interesting though, Danny, is because like obviously people associate you with the time with St Mirren and winning the League Cup, but huge success when you went to Cowan Beath, there were a club that had kind of fallen in the doldrums a little bit, and you were able to take them into back-to-back promotions. Did some of the things that you learned from your time there, were you able to translate it over? Was it a good learning ground for you?
It was an absolutely wonderful learning curve for me. At that particular time when I got the opportunity to manage Cowan Beath, I'd already had a short period season as assistant manager, player manager, under Brian Welsh, etc. The club had then got relegated that season, and they parted with Brian and offered me the job, and I took it. Now, at that particular time, I then brought Brian Hamilton in with me, and we recruited well, brought good players in. Dan McGregor bought him £1,500 from Trenin Juniors, I think it was, at that particular time, working with some good players. A good couple of loan deals for Hearts. Big John Armstrong was good for us. Big lad, big centre back, Joe Mabu. You know, good experienced players. We Mark Baxter, club captain. So they were. And we managed to go out there and get a promotion, or back to back promotions, and that was absolutely fantastic. At that particular time, it was good for me. My good friend, Robert Patterson, who I had down at Gretna with me when I was heading the academy down there, he came and helped as we had a group of kids at Cowden Beat at that particular time that were full time, so be it, Ian. So we were working with these kids on a daily basis, and so many of these kids were starting to make that breakthrough, particularly in their second year. And I think out of all those kids that we had, about 12 kids, I think about 9 of them are still playing today. So they were great in terms of every one of them broke into Cowden Beast first team. But going into that 2 years of the back-to-back promotions, Ian, you know, building the squad and getting to learn what management was all about, and not just management, I was actually on my pro licence at that particular time. So I was working with great players, great coaches that were now looking to gain that qualification. It was a great group, so it was. And any time that you would go for a gathering, you would come back refreshed with different ideas. Brian Hamilton used to always say to me, because it was a 2-year process, your pro license, and Brian used to say, you've been away this weekend, haven't you? Have you been away a few days this week on that pro license? I say, hi, how do you? He says, you always come back with more energy and different ideas. Within that 2 years, I wasn't just a manager at Cowden Beath. I was more like a general manager day to day. I was doing absolutely everything. I was groundsman. You know, I was doing the catering, you name it, the coaching of the young players, the maintenance work at the ground, etc. Always trying to, and it takes a battle, this Cowden Beath, about the state of the place. You know, the nickname at the San Siro and all this type of stuff. And it wasn't the most pleasing in the eye, but we tried to make it as best as we could, you know, with the finances that we had and try to dust it. You know, you've got race cars going around it every other Saturday as well. So for me, one of the biggest things when I eventually moved on to St Mirren Football Club It gave me a great understanding and great knowledge and a great appreciation of the roles and the responsibility of everybody else involved at a football club and the organisation. It's not just behind, it's not just the team, the players, you know, behind the team. There's a team behind that. And, you know, I think at a lot of clubs, these people that do some fantastic jobs go unrecognised, you know. So it's very, very much a joint effort. And I think when you look at that now and you see the top clubs and the size of organisation, the size of coaching staff that they have, but not even just in the coaching staff, you know, they bring their admin, they bring the full team behind the team out. And I think that is key when you start getting it from, when you start getting the structure right, you know, for the top, then it filters right through to the field.
This is probably usually a question you'd only ask your wife, Danny, but were Cowden Beef doing so well? Were you sexy at that point? Were teams courting you? Did you?
That time I went away, my family holiday, and I was looking actually forward. I was looking forward to managing in the Championship now. So I was and starting to build, starting to recruit. And as you do at that particular time, there's a few players that were holding off. Cowden Beef at that particular time was owned by the two Brewster brothers, who put a lot of wealth into that. And, you know, they were characters, they were rugby men, they weren't really football men. And they ran it, you know, as a business, I think mainly for the stock cars, to be perfectly honest, Ian. But when you do get a wee bit of success like that, particularly in back-to-back promotions, and particularly maybe then going to the Championship and the prospect of bigger gates, bigger clubs coming in, so more financial gain for them. But what they didn't do very well was the side of things that they didn't tie their players up quickly enough throughout that summer. And I know a lot of part-time players wait, you know, and try and keep their options open and look for the best deal possible. But, you know, we had good players there. But when I then went to Turkey, there was a bit of noise, there was a bit of contact made. They would have been interested in speaking with St Mirren. Mentioned that I was on holiday, but I'd be very keen to speak to them next day. Permission was given on my return, which was 3 or 4 days later. So it allowed me to do a good bit of homework on the club itself. And then permission was granted from Cowden Beef for me to go and speak to them, because I was still, I think, 6 month contract. My contract ended up, when I'd signed it, ended up halfway through a season. How that worked out, Ian, I don't know. So I still had a 4 or 5 month on that contract. And then I came. Compensation, you know, both ways was dealt with. I thought Cowden Beef, you know, they got what they wanted, etc. And it allowed me that opportunity to then go and manage in the big league. I ended a wee bit. I always say it's proper the way that you end at a football club, and I think it's also proper the way that you exit a football club. Now, remember the success, and not just down to me, the backroom staff, the supporters, the players in particular, the success that they gave that club. But you've got to create great conditions for that. And I was a wee bit disappointed, because at that particular time, as I said, that Cowden Beef hadn't picked, you know, signed a few players. When I went to St Mirren, it was on the back of that a lot of the players were still under contract. You remember the St Anta money, Ian, and then that went up. So there was still the nucleus of the St Mirren squad on very, very good money. So they were you couldn't move anybody on, etc. They weren't going to get the same deals elsewhere if anybody did want them. So there was very, very little money in the budget to bring players in. So quickly, players that had did well for me, particularly, and I know they'd done it in a couple of divisions lower, but I took Gareth Wardlaw, I took Paul McQuaid, I took Darren McGregor, was there another one? John Robertson, I think I took John Robertson. There was 4 players that I took, you know, which my budget at that particular time at St Mirren allowed me to do so. And these players were now jumping at an opportunity, you know, for full-time football and going better themselves. And Cowdenbeath, you know, weren't too happy in the way that these players had then came to. But, you know, it's like dog eat dog out there. You know, get your business done. You know, that they should have then been looking at, you know, the situation of in the week to 10 days to finalise my deal, you know, at St Mirren Football Club. Somebody at that football club, the hierarchy, should have been speaking to these players to try and get them over the line. Because I certainly knew if I was still the manager at Cowdenbeath Football Club, I would have had them over the line. And that ended a wee bit bitter. Donald Finlay came. I always remember going to one game halfway through that season. I went up. My good friend Bobby Patterson was still working at Cowdenbeath at the club at that particular time. Because I'd recommended Jimmy Nicol for the job, and they wanted to speak to him, Donald Finlay knew. And I spoke, made the contact for Jimmy to, would you be interested in it? Yeah, he said he would. Made the connection there. And that's how Jimmy initially became the manager. So I went up to this one midweek game. It was, as you do, always try to keep your eye on younger players that are out there. So we're up the stand, and as it is, it's a cold, cold night up there, enjoying the game. And as you do, Bobby says, I'm going in for a cup of tea. He says, I'm going in for a cup of tea. And as you came down the stairs of the stand to go through the tunnel to go to the players' lounge, Ian, I got refused entry. So Donald Finlay had told him not to allow me to go in. Now, that was very, very fine. If that's what they're wishing, that's the way that they wanted to treat me. But they could have let me know, you know, rather than just turn the door, I'd have still went to the game. So I've met Donald a couple of times. He's never ever mentioned it. That's probably always been a little bit sure in terms of how that ended. But in terms of the opportunity that Cowdenbeath gave me, you know, in my early management and coaching career, you know, I'll be ever so grateful for that. And, you know, great memories. And it's a club where I got a good history there. You know, it's always been a good stepping stone for managers. Craig Levein, Mixer. All managers have went on to have a reasonable success.
Well, one thing that's really interesting is in my lifetime, there's only ever been two managers of St Mirren that have won a trophy. One of them was Alex Smith, who's an incredibly successful manager. And the other one's the person I'm speaking to right now. And a lot of times when clubs size of St Mirren get through to a final, it's because they've been very, very fortunate with their draw. Nobody can accuse St Mirren of being very fortunate in their draw in the League Cup, because you had to play against effectively three of the biggest four clubs in Scotland.
Yeah.
At the point of view, getting Aberdeen in the quarterfinal, you must be thinking, oh, this is going to be a tough one. You get through that, you've got all the elation of the penalties, and then you get Celtic in the semi. There must be a slight bit of, I don't want to say pessimism, but realism perhaps, that creeps in thinking, well, we'll do our best, but I'm not holding out too much hope.
Yeah. Listen, it was an incredible cup journey. And I've always said that, you know, when we done it with Raith Rovers, there was easier ties than others, etc. But thoroughly deserved, still the same. Doesn't matter what route you go, but sometimes there's a hard route in cup success. And we certainly had that in I think, was it Hamilton the first round, or was it Ayr United the first round? Ayr United the first round, and I think that finished, was it, was that the 1-0?
Hamilton was
1-0. That was a 5-1, and, you know, we get through that one couple, and then the Hamilton one, that was a game where we dominated and kept, you know, swinging that axe at the big three, but, you know, they weren't giving in. They were defending very, very well, was Hamilton that night. And then Lee Mayer, in the last few minutes of the game, from a corner, pops up and puts one on. That takes you through to that. And as you said, Ian, a very, very difficult venue to go to is Aberdeen. Even prior to my time going there, I remember the club hadn't won up there in 27 years, and we had to go up there to secure our in my first season at St Mirren, our league status. So we did, and we managed to do that. Who scored the goal? But one of the guys that I brought for Cowdenbeath, Gareth Wardlaw. So that deal alone, you know, was worth its at Seoul, going up there in the cup, and I remember going to the ballot, and I remember Kenny McLean scoring. Only Kenny McLean could have seen that with his vision and his delivery, but the second goal for us that night was out of this world, and the boys dug in deep, you know, took it right to the wire. And I always remember, you know, we had some of the players on their knees, you know, going into the last few minutes of that game, but and possibly could have made changes, but you wanted your big players and experienced players in there to go in the way the direction of the game was going. Penalty kicks, we managed to come through that. Big Craig Sampson doing absolutely wonders for us, saving a couple, and the boys, you know, the boys stepping up to the mark and tucking them away. And as you then say, and as a manager, when you're in these big draws, particularly semi-finals, etc., the media always expect you to be attending these draws. And I remember we had to go to Edinburgh, I think it was a press conference, and in these things with the live, there's a wee delay, as you know, Ian, with the media. I would have my phone all set with the names in the hat, and I was ready to go. And I was always respectful in the way that I would always let the chairman know straight away who we've got. So I remember it coming through, and it comes out Celtic, and then it comes out St Mirren. So I've texted Celtic right away to the chairman. 10 seconds later, oh shit. So exactly what you say there, right away, the pessimism that comes in. And that was the pessimism at St Mirren Football Club was George Campbell. George was the vice chairman. What a great character he was, though. I loved George, you know. Always made the training ground an open door. George Brian Coslin, chairman, would come up, would have tea, coffee, and particularly in my first season, it was a very strenuous one. It was stressful, you know, learning what the Premier League was all about, learning what St Mirren Football Club was all about, and the expectations, and, you know, the expectations and managing players at that level. So George was fantastic in the way that I think he could see that stress at times, you know, out of the media, and he would just come in there and he would just make me laugh. And he was fantastic at that. Was George Campbell. So then going back into the semi final, alone, and just prior to going to the semi final game, it was a great achievement for the club, not only for the first time in the club's history, but I was delighted for, in particular, you know, the chairman, Stuart Gilmore, Brian McCausland and George Campbell, because if it wasn't for these guys, you know, in the times when St Mirren Football Club were basically in financial difficulty, you know, I remember George always saying that his wife would say, "How's your pension doing?" He would be driving by Paisley and he'd say, "It's in there, head. It's in there." And he's no lie. He wasn't lying at that. So for the guys to hang in there and get that success, you know, and to be connected with the club at such an important club at a time in the club's history, you know, winning that League Cup, I was absolutely delighted for them, and they deserved that. But what they invested in the club with their time, their finances and their emotions, no doubt about that. But going into the semi-final game again, I remember maybe about 6 months ago, I used to have that game on Sky prior to me moving home. Ian, you know how it was on your digital box and you could save it, etc. Mm-hmm. So that's, I had that. But then when you move home, your box doesn't carry that weight for some reason, or they lost it anyway. But I never had the game. So I'd phoned a good friend in the BBC who'd managed to get me a copy, and as they sent it out, I sat down and watched it, and I forgot how good we were that day, with the ball and without the ball. Going into that game, 5 or 6 games prior to St Mirren facing Celtic in my time as tenor, as manager, I hadn't even laid a glove on them, hadn't even scored a goal against them. Now we did going into that semi-final. But what we certainly learned about ourselves and what we certainly learned about the opposition, you learn a great deal about yourself, but you also learn a great deal about them. And we came up with a game plan, and, you know, we worked hard on it. We attacked with 5, we defended with 5, we spoke about Samaras and key players that would be allowed them come inside. You know, it's the transition when you allow them to come inside that it really opens you up. So we really forced them that night. And Davey Van Zanten, was absolutely outstanding that day for us. To a man, we were outstanding. But Vincent, you know, in terms, when I was watching the game back, you just forget how good they were. But the game, as these Cup Classic ones do, you know, it took its turn. I remember we signed the boy, Ismael Gonçalves. Nobody had heard of him. I didn't even hear him until the week before, until Austin McPhee had brought him on our radar through Ian Cathro. We looked at video footage of him. We liked what we'd seen. We brought the boy over. We spoke. I think he was only over for maybe 3 or 4 days. And although we didn't know a great deal about him in terms of what he was going to bring, certainly Celtic wouldn't have known a great deal about him either. And that'd certainly be the case. And, you know, we managed to go up a great goal, by the way. And it shows you in the way that we break. And Gonçalves is going through. And, you know, I think it's Gary Teal. Was that the one? I think that was the one Gary Teal slips out. Or was that the Tino one? It was the one that he goes through. I'm trying to recollect the game here, Ian. But in the semi-final, no, sorry, that was the final one with Gary Teal. The one that I'm on about, Ismael Gonçalves, there's a good little bit of combination play. It comes back, great movement for wee Paul McGowan, and Gonçalves just runs inside the fullbacks and manages to get his, stretches out his leg and puts it in. So within 10, 15 minutes, we've now scored the goal against Celtic. Gonçalves is there and the game's going well, so it is. And then just before half time, Celtic, as they do, they've always got a threat. Hooper was causing a bit of problem in behind with his movement. And he manages to get them back in the game at 1-1, just in the stroke at half time. We then go back out at half time, we regroup, we speak about the things that we've done well in the game and the dangers that maybe Celtic are causing. Refocusing on that game plan, you know, prior to the game, we'd fueled them with belief about fantastic victories over Celtic and big games in the past, you know, fueling with that belief and going to be the next guys to go and do that. And as they came back out the second half, the game gets going and bang, Celtic coming into the block, you know, and Jim Goodwin goes to go and block and, you know, the ball deflects, but his hands are down. He's in a position where he's lunging, but his hands are out at the same time. You know, hold your hands out to go to ground, Ian. It was that situation. And the ball certainly does strike his arm. But for me, and Wally gives a penalty right away. So he does. So Big Sammy has a, Craig Sampson has a great moment. So he does. Absolutely wonderful save. And that lifts you once again. And from there on in, you know, we took control of the game. We managed to get ourselves in front. We then managed to get ourselves further ahead again. I think it was we Paul McGowan, we actually got a penalty as well. Mark McCausland as well, and putting a cross on, and Stevie Thompson with good quality ball slightly behind them. You know, I think that one, did that put us 2-1 up? Was it the penalty 2-1? Been that wee while since I've watched it. But it gives us that wee bit of cushion, but we're still playing. There's still plenty of time on the clock to go. And Celtic are probing, but we're handling them very well. And then Charlie Mulgrew, I think he gets one in the last 30 seconds of the game. Certainly, I don't even think we took centre after that, to be fair. So that was a great moment in itself. And it shows you big clubs and top managers, you know, Neil Lennon. And I knew Neil from our Northern Ireland days together. So I'd been on a couple of holidays in the same venues as families, etc. So I know Neil well. And he just says, and he'd be disappointed, but he just says, now that you've beaten the best, you've got to go and win it. And he was right. And then we go into the final itself. And I think it was just a great occasion for start to finish. And when I say start to finish, not the day itself, but the build up to it. It was certainly built up as the people's final. And a guy a great deal of credit I've not mentioned, and he was a great general manager for me at the time, was Brian Caldwell at St. Martin Football Club. He was a guy that did, you know, a hell of a lot behind the scenes. And on that build up to the cup final, etc., you know, he certainly was a big part and influence the community behind us and the schools that we went to, and making sure that everybody felt connected in all the local surrounding areas, not just in Paisley itself. And that was great. That was great.
Do you think because your history with clubs that were always punching upwards, so Raith Rovers defied the odds, Partick Thistle always one of the smaller clubs in Glasgow, does that help you a bit then as St Mirren manager? Because you know a little bit about what all these fans have been going through. You know how much a victory means. Celtic and Rangers win a trophy every year. It's water off a back to them. But did that instill a kind of sense of determination in yourself and the squad that this is our time, we're going to do it?
Yeah, I think when you do look in terms of the way that the cup run was going, particularly from maybe the Hamilton game, you know, the 1-0, although we thoroughly deserved that 1-0, you know, going into the Aberdeen game, going to penalties, the way that panned out, very difficult venue for St Mirren over those years going past. And then you go to the semi-final, who you're playing the best team in the country at that particular time, Ian. And then to go to the final and play, you know, Hearts alone, who on paper are stronger, you know, the budgets that we're competing against. And once again, you know, once you come that far, it wasn't a sake of, you know, getting the players in that motivated. Everybody now know how far we'd come, what was at stake, and what bit of history this club, what these sets of players could make for themselves, and more importantly, the football club. And that's one thing, regardless of anything, that they can maybe always take. Chairman, directors, managers, managers will maybe take players' jobs away from them, or so, et cetera, and chairman will take manager jobs away from them. But nobody will ever take away, you know, the first manager, first set of group of players to win the League Cup for St Mirren Football Club. Nobody will ever take that away from them.
And you know, there's something that nobody will ever take away, Danny, is the fact that maybe the greatest manager of all time, Sir Alex Ferguson, he was manager of St Mirren, and he couldn't win a trophy when he was at that club, but you could. Something that you'll always be able to hold over him.
Well, listen, he's done pretty well, you know, in terms of, you know, the unbelievable career. And I think that just shows not just the greatness of the man and the football that Man United played at that particular time and the great career that he had, you know, how well he had St Mirren punching, getting recognised by Aberdeen, you know, and the great success that he's had at Aberdeen, winning European Cups, challenging the Old Firm, probably matching the Old Firm at that time. His mind games, you know, and how he gets the media to them and us. You know, he then goes to Man United and slowly but gradually turns the club into the way that a big club should be run. And I think the key thing for me is that he gets the infrastructure. He got the infrastructure of each club run properly, for the top, you know, to the ground. And you know, once he has that running, to turn, to be there in Man United for all those years, and to go through three or four rebuilding squads, you know, that is absolutely incredible. But that is just somebody that is in another level. You know, he was ahead of his time. And he was certainly, as what we would call it now, he was a Guardiola of his generation. There's no doubt about that.
Well, Danny, I have to thank you for being so candid and refreshingly honest, speaking to us in the episode today. I'm slightly worried though, because I'm going to Germany for the Euros, and by associating myself with you, I might get implicated in a terrorist crime from the 1980s.
I'll try that balaclava, you. So
that brings us to the end of another episode of the CSI Football Podcast. Join us next week for another forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. Our website's at csi.com, where you can find all our socials. Until next week, thank you very much. And thank you very much, Danny.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really enjoyed the show. Keep up the good work.